Let's turn to Genesis chapter 44. I want to read verses 14 through to 17. And we want to consider that section, verses 1 to 17, with the key verse, which is verse 16 in mind. So reading from verse 14. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there, and they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, "What deed is this you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination?" Then Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found." But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. And as for you, go up in peace to your father." But what a difference a few hours makes in the life of every man, woman, or child at certain times. And we see here, after Joseph's kindness, in spite of their fear and foreboding, even from the time that they had first returned from the land of Egypt, because of the demands that were made by the prime minister of Egypt, and the holding of Simeon back until that demand was met, which was to bring Benjamin, the youngest son, the apple of the eye of their aged father, back to Egypt. In spite of the fact that time had passed, the fear was looming over them, and they were back now in Egypt. And Joseph begins at their second trip to bestow kindness upon kindness on them. And we saw this last Lord's Day. First, the kindness of the steward about the money, then to bring out Simeon and present him before them, seeing him in good health and good spirits, would certainly have raised their spirits. And then there was the generous and lavish welcoming hospitality to them and their animals. And then there is the speech of Joseph, which is dripping with multiple kindnesses, asking about them, their aged father, and then speaking personally to the youngest son of Jacob. And finally, they were guests in the most powerful house, apart from Pharaoh, of the most powerful man apart from Pharaoh, who had prepared and invited them to this lavish feast. And as we come into chapter 44, just a few hours after that event, let's remind ourselves how this section closes. Verse 33 of chapter 43 says this: "And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked in astonishment at one another. Then he took servings to them from before him. But Benjamin's serving was five times as much as any of theirs. So they drank and were merry with him." They feasted late into the night. And their worst fears would have been alived, and they would have been allayed. And they were at ease in the house of this prime minister. But a few hours passes, And morning breaks, and things change dramatically. The text here tells us in the very first verse of Genesis 44 that even as they were feasting, or at least before they settle for the night, he directs, that is the prime minister, to them, he is still unrecognized as Joseph. Verse 1, he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill their sacks to the brim, return their money back to them a second time. But in the sack of the youngest son, to place his special silver cup. This, of course, is a setup that will hang them and put their life in danger. And it's not 2 to 3 hours before they take off in the morning that their world begins to fall apart. Because Joseph not only plants this silver cup, but he sends his steward with a posse to catch up to them. And I assume it would be no more than 2 or 3 hours before they catch up. The men rise up early, they are on their way, and suddenly they are caught up by this steward and accused of this theft. And as I say, now the world, their world begins to fall apart. All their ease and merriment, all the fears which had been dispelled the evening before, is now coming back with a vengeance to take hold of them. First of all, they're perplexed, but they begin to reason. In verse 8, we are told that they begin to reason in this way, quite logically. Look, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan the money which we found in the mouth of our sacks. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Perfectly logical. They're trying to prove their honesty and their character. Why would they bring this money back in the first place if they intended to be stealing from this generous man? At the same time, they're absolutely confident that they will be found innocent. So they offer an extreme and painful reprisal just to give assurance to the steward, verse 9, with whomever of your servants it is found, let him die, and we also will be my Lord's servants. The steward, mercifully, in one sense, does not take them at their word completely, but he's quick to take hold of their offer. And he says, well, the one with whom the cup is found will be our slave and not put to death as they offer. And so they begin eagerly, quickly. The text tells us that very quickly, speedily, verse 11, each man let down his sack. And you can imagine the drama. One by one, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, and so on. And of course, they're increasing in confidence because with none of them is the cup found until it comes to that one son with whom Jacob's life is tied up. Their father Israel's life is tied up, Benjamin. And behold, the cup is found in his sack. Now they begin to disintegrate emotionally and psychologically. They have no more words to say, and we are told that they tear their clothes, and they are in complete disarray. Verse 13, they tore their clothes. And of course, they made their way back to Egypt. They're ordered back to Egypt. They're desolate. They're afraid. Their worst fears have come to haunt them. And as we look at a passage like this, how are we to understand it? Because it is very clear that this whole incident was engineered by Joseph over a long period of time. The first visit, we don't know how many months, maybe a year, maybe longer, that the first supply of grain which they carried back from Egypt, we don't know how long, but at least a few months. And all this while, Joseph has so engineered things that there will be this fear hanging over them. Simeon is held back. And so what are we to make of his scheming and his engineering to put the brothers in such a position? In the first trip, and now in the second trip. In the second trip, he begins first by showing extreme and repeated and multiple kindnesses. And then, even though they're not dead, it's like in the midst of their merriment, the guillotine comes down emotionally and factually upon them, because there is no escape from Joseph's power and from the power of the Egyptian prime minister. He's relentless. Verse 15, and Joseph says to them, "What deed is this that you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination?" And to make matters worse, when they offer themselves as slaves, he says, "Far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup is found, he shall be my slave. As for you, go up in peace to your father." And so here we have him turning the screws, as it were, because this is the one son that will do maximum hurt and grieve their aged father. So the fix was in. The trap had closed. And their worst fears have become a nightmare to them. They're far away in the land of Egypt. All their guarantees, you remember their confident guarantees to their father Jacob, Reuben especially, and then Judah, that they will bring this son back in safety. All of it falls to pieces. And Joseph has engineered all this. Now this leaves the reader of this story with a number of legitimate questions, does it not? It perplexes us why Joseph would do this. Now, first of all, the unbelief. Those who are ignorant of God's ways and God's word will react, at the very least, in a very confused and distasteful manner. But as I said, as we started this brief series of Genesis, history, and the Bible is mostly history. And this history is given to us because it's the theater of God's activities. And the unbeliever and the ignorant of the scriptures have no idea. And so they ask questions. They're not only perplexed, they ask questions like, "Is this not returning evil for evil. Not evil as in moral evil, but scheming in such a way so that it seems calamity is going to strike them. Is it not immoral to falsely accuse his own brothers after setting them up? Is it not cruel over a long period of time to put them through this kind of fearful cruelty? But in a word or two, the answer to those who are not aware of the whole of the scriptures and the God of the scriptures is that if you read the story of Joseph, Joseph has particular reasons and purpose for doing this. And it's legitimate. Secondly, we need to know the God of Joseph and the whole of the Bible before we can begin to understand this sort of dealing of Joseph. But this morning, however, I want to speak to those of us, all of us, I trust, who are in some way or measure aware of the whole of the scriptures and the dealings of God with his people and his ways with sinful man, even his own people. First and foremost, Joseph engineered these situations because he wanted to test them and the state of their heart. It's perfectly legitimate on Joseph's, from Joseph's end. 20 to 22 years ago, the brothers had resented Jacob's special love for the sons of his beloved wife, Rachel. We have to know the history of that. He was cheated by Laban into marrying Leah, and yet he loved her. But his first love was Rachel. And Rachel had died on his way back to the land of promise. On his way back to the land of promise, God had blessed him greatly, and he would have surely looked forward to enjoying the blessings of Jehovah in the land of Canaan with his beloved Rachel, for whom he served 14 years, and it seemed like nothing to him. There's true love. And she had passed away, and all he had left was these two boys. It's quite understandable that he had a soft spot for these boys. And what did these brothers do? These adult sons of Jacob, who were well treated by him on the whole, they resented and festered with envy. So much so, they were willing to talk about taking out the life of Joseph, but ended up selling him as slave to the Ishmaelites, who took him back to Egypt. Now you see, Joseph has put them in exactly the same place to test them. Joseph, as far as they know, is no more. But here is Benjamin, the beloved son of Jacob. And they can easily save their skin. And this is the one other son, whom Jacob loves in a special way. If they were the same people and there was no change in them, they would behave exactly as they had 20 years ago and do away with him. They would not care. And so he puts them to the test. And God puts his children to the test, does he not? We see this throughout the scriptures. If your faith, we've been looking at 1 Peter over the last few months, your faith, which is tested by severe and grievous trials. And for him to set the stage so that he might assess them, that's important. You cannot have reconciliation without change. You have to have a spirit of general forgiveness so that You leave things in the hand of God, but there can be no reconciliation. But people have to be proven. It's the same thing in the church. Pastors and elders and deacons have to be proven. They have to be tested. And so Joseph was putting them in exactly the same position. But what do we see? We see God's continuing work in the hearts of these brothers in a miraculous way under this test, under these extreme conditions. This particular sorrow has not hit Jacob yet. We can thank God for the fact they lived in an age when there was no internet or mobile phones, otherwise they would have texted him. But at this stage he's safe from the sharpness and the piercing sorrow that is striking the brothers. And the brothers are being sifted and weighed and tested, but they come out with the evidence of a miraculous change. As we go through the book of Genesis, the first thing we see in them is an increasing awareness and acceptance of their own sense of sin, their own sinfulness. This is always true in a growing believer's life. You saw that in chapter 38, if you're reading through the Bible, which you should be, reading through the Bible, how Judah, after it committed that dreadful, two dreadful wrongs, when he's confronted by Tamar, he says this: "You are more righteous than I." Suddenly there's a change in this man. But we saw the change of all of them and their hearts in Genesis 42 and verse 21. At least I referred to it when we looked at 43 a few weeks ago. This is what they say when they're caught in a trap. They said to one another, "We are truly guilty concerning our brother." They were not asked about their brother. "We are truly guilty." It's a collective confession. They were all involved in this. "For we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore this distress has come upon us." It is just that we be distressed. This is a miraculous work of God. God is beginning to work over the years, not only in the life of Joseph. Many years ago when we looked through the book, when we went through the book of Genesis, remember, some of you might, or you might have it in your consciousness, we said that we attempted to look only at what God was doing in the life of Joseph. But he was miraculously working in the lives of all the brothers, Judah and all of them. And this increasing sensitivity to sin, a deepening awareness, and the sense of rightness. That's the first thing a believer begins to experience. It's a miraculous work. The unbelievers, and even the believer does this from time to time, but the unbeliever is, "Why me? Why does God allow these things?" That the ignorant and the unbelieving are the things of God. But this miraculous change occurs when the Spirit of God begins to work in their hearts. That's the first thing. We see this again in verse 16 of our text. This increasing awareness. And now this awareness is pinpointed. Look at verse 16 or verse of chapter 44. "Then Judah said, 'What should we say to my Lord? What should we speak? Or how should we clear ourselves?'" And then this: "God has found the iniquity of your servants." It's the confession. But then there is not only increasing awareness, there is true humility. Look at verse 14. "They fell down at his feet. They tore their clothes." Look at their speech in verse 16. I needn't stay with it. You just have to read the scriptures. If you're reading through the scriptures and you look at the prayers of the great men of God, read the prayers of King Solomon at the height of his political and economic and spiritual prosperity. He begins to waver later spiritually, but the height of his blessedness in spiritual life 2 Kings chapter 8 and its corresponding chapter in Chronicles. Look at the humility of the man of God and that of the prayers of Nehemiah and the prayers of Daniel and the confessions and prayers of the great Apostle Peter and Apostle Paul, the chiefest of sinners. In the present tense, I am the chief of sinners. Humility and awareness of sin. And thirdly, an increasing awareness of the sovereignty of God in all this. And notice the confession in verse 16. God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Not this prime minister has tricked us. But God has found out. They begin to realize that they deserve far greater indictment because of the guilt of their sin. And fourthly, you notice the replacement of self-love for love of their father and their brothers. Again, verse 16. Here we are, my Lord's slaves. Remember, 20 years ago, they sold their brother Joseph into slavery. Now they're willing to sell themselves into slavery for their father's sake and for Benjamin's sake. They have been changed completely. These are the marks of the divine workings in a person's life. It's not how successful he or she is. Even in Christian work, it's not how able they are. Even in Christian work, it's these marks, increasing sensitivity to sin. You listen to the prayers of those who are mature in the faith, and you will notice an increasing sensitivity to sin. Not despair, because there is confidence that God will forgive them of their sin, but increasing sensitivity and sorrow for sin, and increasing awareness of the sovereignty of God, the first cause of things in your life. Stop attacking the secondary causes, however troubled they are. These men have come a long way because of the miraculous work of God the Spirit in their lives. So let me close with these final applications, people of God. I've already given plenty, but let me close with this. People of God, when you're discouraged by providence, and when doubt sets in because there are testings and difficulties in your life, when life seems to be shaking at the very foundation, remember this. God is still at work in you and through you. And if you can sense in your life an increasing awareness of a sense of sin, an increasing allocation of the things that happen to you which are not pleasant to the divine and the sovereign God of the heavens. If you can sense in some way an increasing humility in the sense of bowing before God and his wisdom and his omnipotence, and an increasing concern, not for yourself, but for your Father in heaven and his name and his glory, for your Savior and his name and his glory. And this is revealed first and foremost in our love for the church and acting in the best interests of the church. Then God is miraculously at work in you. And this is exactly how he is at work in the lives of people. And the Bible is full of the encouragement not to despair when troubles and difficult providences arise in your lives. Listen to what Jehovah says through Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 2. Speaking through Moses to the children of Israel, he says this, "And you shall remember that Jehovah your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness." Why? "To humble you and to test you." Don't you realize that you are proud? Should I not realize that I'm proud? At my best moments, I realize how proud I am. The Puritans used to say that if God had not let difficult circumstances in our lives, we would be virtual devils. Do we not understand that we are so self-centered instead of God-centered? God leads us through difficult ways to humble us, not to harden us. And to test us. And we are to remember that. To test you. And what is he testing? To know what was in your heart. For whom to know what was in his heart? But if you're a believer, no matter what your circumstances, even if you're going through a difficult period, and there are dangerous situations potentially awaiting you in the future, our hearts must stand and stay on this glorious truth that Jehovah our God, far greater than the Prime Minister in Egypt, the one who is enthroned in the heavens, his thoughts are precious toward his people while he weeps over. And while wrath is being built up against those who reject and despise the kindness and the long-suffering of God, his thoughts toward his own are precious. How great is the sum of them? In fact, the psalmist says, if I should count them, they would be more in number than the sands. Or, as the hymn writer puts it, "Tell out my soul the greatness of the Lord. Unnumbered blessings give my spirit voice." Better talk about these things. We can talk about a lot of things, but never give voice to the unnumbered blessings of Jehovah because of the promise of his word. And believer, you should take note, and I should take note, no matter what divine providence looks like, we should not walk by sense and our own wisdom and understanding. Why? Because as William Cooper so wonderfully puts it, and we sing it often, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable minds, over never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides his smiling face. Isn't that what happens in the story? It's an exact description of what takes place in this story. But that is only a finite reflection of what Jehovah is doing in the lives of his people. But believer, also take notice in the last verse. He invites them to eat and drink with them and to be merry in his presence. I close with the quotes of one of the greatest German Old Testament scholars. Klaus Westermann says about this particular passage and this meal, and I quote, "The meal has an exalted meaning in both the Old and the New Testament." You have to listen carefully now. "The simple satisfaction of hunger would not be considered a meal in the Bible. One need only remember the shared meals of Jesus and his disciples, the last of which demonstrates this in a special way. The meal is not just an expression of a communion, but it demonstrates in a special way the commonality of the one with whom you sit down to have a meal. The acceptance of a guest into the fellowship of the meal is therefore simultaneously the granting of participation in one's own existence. It's a remembrance table. It's fellowship, it's all that. But more than that, it's granting fellowship into one's own existence. And this is exactly what the Lord has done for us. He's brought us into his family. He's grafted us into himself. And he's made us a people to eat and drink and to be merry with him with an eternal future. So may the Lord help us to remember his kindnesses and grow in repentance and in trust despite the frowning providences or the dangers and the difficulties. Why? Because he has all things in hand to shape us and to mold us and then bring us and gather us to himself. So let us eat and drink of the bread of life, the word of life, and be merry with him. Amen.